You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
Today, is God a good theory?
The interesting ways to think about God are ways that brings him under the microscope that can be talked about in terms of evidence for and against ordinary scientific hypotheses. So I think that in that sense, God is an idea that about the universe that could be true or false.
How birds may be using quantum mechanics to navigate.
Birds have at least a sixth sense that humans don't seem to have, which is the capacity to sense something about the Earth's magnetic field. So it's not surprising that they would have it. How does it work?
And could we have discovered entirely different fundamental laws of physics if we had measured time in a different way?
When I first encountered this puzzle, I felt really disturbed and uncomfortable about it. I felt it was undermining our ability to really believe strong, concrete facts about the universe.
She's Zia Morali.
And he's Brendan Foster.
Welcome to the first podcast of 2013 from the Foundational Questions Institute. As you can probably tell from our name, we like to, question the foundations of physics and reality. And so we thought we'd start off the year by discussing one of the biggest questions of all about the origin of the universe. Is God behind everything?
So nothing too controversial then. God has been in the air for the past few weeks. For instance, at the end of last year, theoretical physicist, FQXI member, black hole expert and committed Christian Don Page posted a paper suggesting that if God exists, he'd choose to create a multiverse of many parallel universes rather than just one universe because it's more mathematically beautiful. As I understand it, Page's argument is that though we often see human suffering when we look around us, a problem that has caused many to doubt the existence of a benevolent God, if a multiverse exists, then perhaps when we sum over all the different versions of ourselves in each parallel reality, the overall amount of good in the multiverse is maximized. In that way, God allows the best collection of possible universes to exist.
Trust me to be stuck in the parallel universe where I have to do this podcast month after month. Will my suffering never end? I'm not sure what I think of Don Page's paper, though. I'm not even sure that God is something...
That sounded dramatic. That sounded like God was intervening there.
So I'm not even sure that God is something that lies within the scope of a scientific podcast.
Yeah, I wasn't sure either, to be honest. But earlier this month, I attended the Is God Explanatory meeting that brought together astronomers, cosmologists, philosophers and theologians at the University of Oxford, and where the question of whether God should be thought of as a scientific theory was discussed. One of the contributors to the meeting was Caltech cosmologist and FQXI member Sean Carroll, who gave a number of talks. We chatted about whether God can be assessed as a theory alongside other cosmological ideas, such as the multiverse. We also discussed Don Page's paper. The meeting is just one of a number that are being held as part of a broader program to examine the philosophy of cosmology. Now, cosmology is an ancient subject that was often classified as philosophical in the past. Only relatively recently has it become more established as a precision science, as Carroll explained.
Yeah, I think that cosmology is something that people have thought about for a very, very long time. It has not become very scientific until relatively recently, let's say the last 100 years. What we call modern scientific cosmology really didn't take off until two things. Number one, Einstein with general relativity, giving us a framework in which to talk about the universe as a whole and its behavior. And then Hubble establishing that the universe was very large and expanding. And so that put in place the Big Bang theory and so forth, and that really established what cosmology was as a science. But it was still very hard to get data that actually adjudicated between different possibilities. So it's really in the last few decades that we've really begun doing precision cosmology and measuring the inventory of the universe, precisely characterizing how fast it's expanding and talking about what the future might be.
So you've been invited to speak at this particular meeting, which is called the Is God Explanatory Meeting. So can you explain a bit about what people have been talking about here and what you're planning to talk about, what you have spoken about already?
And so really what all of us are talking about are questions like, could it conceivably be sensible and interesting to have God as a category that is helpful when we try to understand the universe?
So the title of one of your talks is God is Not a Good Theory. So the first question is, what do you mean by a theory? Are you talking about a scientific theory? And then what do you mean by that? Or are you talking about something wider than that, a philosophical theory?
Yeah, I put that as the title because I wanted to preempt the kind of discussion that says we shouldn't talk about God in the same way that we talk about scientific theories. I think there's no question that the interesting ways to think about God are ways that brings him under the microscope that can be talked about in terms of evidence for and against ordinary scientific hypotheses. So I think that in that sense, God is an idea that about the universe that could be true or false. And the way that we have empirically done a good job of judging the worthiness of such ideas is to make predictions on the basis of them and compare them with data. That's what science is all about.
But that sort of seems a little bit unfair, just simply because I think nobody has tried to make predictions based on the idea of God.
Certainly people have claimed that God provides the best possible explanation for things that we have already observed. For instance, there's a famous argument in favor of the existence of God on the basis of the fine-tuning of the universe that we see around us. The parameters of physics and cosmology allow for the existence of life, even though, the argument goes, there's a very small fraction of all such possible parameters that would allow for life to exist. Therefore, our best explanation is that God made them that way. And that's a kind of prediction. That's kind of using God as an explanation. And my point in the talk was that you don't get credit for using God as an explanation for something unless you should also be able to predict other things that you haven't yet observed. And nobody does try to do that in general. And so I'm saying that that is trying to have things both ways in an illegitimate way.
You know, you brought up the fine-tuning problem. Can you talk a little bit more about perhaps some scientific explanations for that, or what you would think constitutes a good theory put forward to explain this?
Well, it's a difficult question to answer because the fact that we are allowed to exist is not something that could have been false from our point of view, right? So it's not even clear there is any sensible discussion to be had about this particular question. But to the extent that there is one, there's various different possibilities. The simplest possibility is we just got lucky. You know, fortunately, the parameters of physics and cosmology allow for life to exist. How fortunate is that? A slightly more predictive possibility is that there is a multiverse, that conditions in the universe as a whole, the largest possible conception of the universe, are physically different from place to place. And in that case, if the parameters that govern physics take on different values in different locations, of course there will be a strong selection effect. We will find ourselves in a region where the parameters are hospitable to the existence of life. And I think that's a very plausible scientific theory. I don't know if it's right or not, but it's certainly on the table as an explanation for why the parameters seem to be finely tuned.
Do you think that the two possibilities that you've put up there as possible explanations have to stand in opposition to people believing in God?
No, you certainly could believe in, let's say, the multiverse and believe in God. I don't think there's any objection to that at all. But many of the arguments from theologians about the fine-tuning fact about the universe that we apparently see, say that they don't like the multiverse hypothesis. It's ontologically extravagant, it's asking us too much, and God is a better explanation because it's very simple and he doesn't require all these extra universes. So even though I think you could allow both for the multiverse and God, the ideas that are conventionally put in opposition are multiverse versus God.
I guess now might be a good time to bring up a sort of a very different paper that came up on the archive a few weeks ago by Don Page, where he tried to, I guess, address the fact that the multiverse and God are often put in opposition and try to make a case that maybe if God existed, he would actually choose a multiverse over a single universe. What do you think of that idea?
Well, Don is a firm believer in the existence of God, Don Page, and he's also a very well-educated theoretical cosmologist. So he knows that when we look at the universe, we don't see God violating the laws of physics all the time. So therefore, he concludes that apparently it's a feature of God that God likes to obey the laws of physics, or at least preserve them. And therefore, he says, if we have laws of physics that would naturally give rise to a multiverse, that's what God would naturally let happen. So from my point of view, what you're saying there is that God exists, but the universe behaves in exactly the way it would behave if God didn't exist. And then I begin to wonder what the point of invoking God in the first place was.
I get to go to a lot of cosmology meetings as part of my job. And one thing that's quite interesting, especially if they're sort of covering a number of different topics, is I've noticed that, you know, there'll be a session about the multiverse. And perhaps trying to detect evidence of the multiverse, or just, you know, talking about various theories. And a large number of the cosmologists and physicists at the meeting will sort of roll their eyes. Some of them walk out. And if you go and ask them why, they'll say, well, you know, this isn't science. This is religion. This is just philosophy. You know, I think what's upsetting to a certain portion of people is that they think it's a bit of a waste of time to think about something that perhaps realistically, at least for now, can't be falsified. What do you think about that argument?
Well, I think there are two things going on. One is that many scientists are really not very good at the philosophy of science. They have a couple of little mottos that they rely on, and they throw them out there, and they try to justify their beliefs about the relative value of different theories and the basis of these sort of cartoonish versions of the philosophy of science. The second is that the multiverse idea is not anywhere near well developed. It's not a clear idea. It does not make clear predictions that we can compare against the data right now. We don't understand the measure problem, the mechanism for making the multiverse. And so in many, many ways, the multiverse is not a very well articulated theory. And so if the multiverse, I think, were well articulated, if it made very clear and crisp predictions, then these objections would go away. And the predictions might be ones where we're not actually observing the multiverse, we're not observing other universes. But if the multiverse made predictions for what we should expect to observe concerning parameters within our observable universe, or is there supersymmetry? Do the supersymmetric particles have masses? What is the dark matter? Is there different kinds of dark matter in different relative abundances? So we can certainly, before we discovered the Higgs, we had the Higgs boson mass, and you can certainly try to make predictions for all of those different features, not to mention cosmological features like the evolution of the dark energy and so forth. So what the multiverse is trying to do is to help us understand what kinds of questions are interesting ones about the universe we do actually observe. This is not just philosophy ungrounded from reality. All of the talk of the multiverse is ultimately motivated by trying to understand the data that we have.
You've mentioned a couple of sort of big mysteries there that we still haven't solved, dark matter, dark energy. So maybe this is a good time to ask you about something that you've recently been blogging about, something that you wanted to talk about at these meetings. I think you put out an equation, and I'll ask you to explain what it is, but we've been getting letters about it at FQXI. So let me sort of hand it over to you to tell us what that equation is and what you hope that it signifies or stands for.
Well, I think it's an underappreciated fact that as we go around in our everyday lives and we see around us, you know, table chairs, sun, moon, and stars, living beings, inorganic beings, these are all collections of atoms and particles that are described by fundamental physics, the standard model of particle physics and general relativity in the case of gravity. And as far as that fundamental physics of everyday life underlying the phenomena that we observe in our everyday existence is concerned, we have a complete theory. We are done. We know what you and I are made out of, and we know the fundamental rules by which the atoms that you and I are made out of behave. And not only do we have a theory that works, we have very, very good reason to believe that that theory is not going to change over the next million years. When it comes to physics beyond our everyday experience, when it comes to black holes or dark matter or the beginning of the universe, then obviously we don't understand the final laws of physics. There's plenty more physics to be discovered. But 1,000 years from now, when we talk about human beings, we will still describe them as being made of the particles in the standard model. If there were other fields, other particles that were relevant to human life or everyday experience, we would have discovered them already. That is a consequence of how quantum field theory works. You can't hide new fields in one way without being able to discover them in some other way. So that's an important milestone for human intellectual achievement. We have a theory that is sufficient to describe the particles that you and I are made out of. Now, people don't like to hear that because either, number one, they say, well, what about black holes and so forth? And I have to point out that black holes are not part of our everyday life. Or number two, they say, well, you can't explain chemistry or biology or economics or anything like that. To which I say, well, obviously not. There's no sense that just because you understand the underlying rules means that you understand the higher level emergent descriptions. That should be perfectly clear. In fact, understanding the underlying rules is of no help when it comes to understanding economics or biology or anything like that.
Did you get a chance to present that equation at this meeting? And what was your sort of point in the context of this discussion about God?
And so I'm going to try to make two points. One is that given this fundamental description in terms of particles and fields, there are consequences of that description. There are limits on the possible higher level descriptions that you can imagine are legitimate. For example, astrology is incompatible with the standard model of particle physics. There's no force of nature that could influence our personality on the basis of where Saturn is on the day we are born or anything like that. For that matter, life after death is not compatible with the standard model. There's no way for the information in a human brain to sort of sustain itself outside the body. On the other hand, that's the first point, the other hand, there's still plenty of room for different higher level descriptions that are compatible with the standard model. I think it's perfectly legitimate to ask questions about free will, about purpose and meaning, about teleology. There are many different emergent descriptions that can be compatible with the same underlying physics. And that's the interesting way forward in terms of relating human life to this fundamental talk about particles and fields.
Well, thank you to Sean Carroll for explaining why he believes science leaves no room for either astrology or religion. Despite having strong views, I think he gave a very balanced argument, weighing up both sides, exactly as we would expect from someone whose star sign is Libra, the scales.
Indeed, very, very balanced. On our podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, we've included a link to Sean's personal blog where you can read more about his trip to Oxford and the equation that he claims explains the underlying physics of our everyday experiences. Not everyone agrees that this audacious claim is correct, though, and we have also linked to FQXI member Ian Durham's counterargument to this claim, and also to Don Page's paper about God and the multiverse.
I always feel tense when our members start to argue. I hope the next item on the podcast is something more soothing and less divisive than the existence of God.
You're in luck, Brendan. We're returning to Oxford again, but this time to talk about robins.
Ah, robins, the lovely little birds. And not at all controversial, thank goodness. I'm pretty certain that everybody agrees that robins exist.
What they don't agree on, however, is how these birds are able to navigate using the Earth's magnetic field. But a team of physicists based in Oxford and at the Centre for Quantum Technologies in Singapore think that the answer may lie in quantum mechanics. Reporter Karine Pickemer met up with team members Simon Benjamin and Eric Gauger and learned about their theory that the humble robin can outperform rudimentary quantum computers built in the lab.
The beautiful song of the European robin. Migratory birds, like the European robin, are extremely good navigators. In summer, they live in Northern Europe, but when the weather is starting to cool, they fly thousands of miles in search of the heat of Northern Africa, seemingly without ever getting lost. For decades, researchers have tried to explain how the birds do this, and one popular idea is that they possess a sixth sense that gives them the ability to feel the Earth's magnetic field. It's also often referred to as a bird or avian compass. Several years ago, Simon Benjamin and Eric Gauger, two theoretical physicists who both work at the University of Oxford as well as the University of Singapore, became interested in understanding the bird's compass from a quantum mechanical point of view. I met up with them in Oxford to find out how biology and quantum mechanics can learn from one another, and particularly how quantum mechanics has helped shed light on how bird navigation might work. I first asked Gauger what exactly quantum biology is.
To me, quantum biology is looking for quantum phenomena in biological processes. In a sense, all of biology is based on chemistry, and you could say it's quantum for that reason. But when I talk about quantum biology, usually sort of deeper properties of quantum mechanics are involved. For example, superpositions, like the ability of quantum systems to be in several places simultaneously on several states at the same time, or entanglement, which is a strange sort of quantum correlation, much stronger than you can have in the classical world. So when these deeper phenomena of quantum mechanics are involved in some sort of biological process, I would refer to that as quantum biology. Realizing that the processes happening in the avian compass are quite similar to systems we study for artificial technologies, we thought we could do some calculations, but those were based on data obtained in behavioral experiments.
But before getting into these experiments and calculations, Benjamin explained the biology of the bird compass.
Birds have at least a sixth sense that humans don't seem to have, which is the capacity to sense something about the Earth's magnetic field. In particular, it can be found in birds that are migratory. So these guys have to make, you know, long trips, and anything that they can have to help them understand where they are and where they should be going is going to be a big advantage. So it's not surprising that they would have it. It's, how does it work? You know, for birds, and in particular the European robin, is very well studied. There's good evidence that the compass sense is in some way associated with the eye.
Benjamin and Gauger have been tapping into a rich seam of ecological data from a group of biologists in Frankfurt in Germany. These researchers have been collaborating with scientists in Scandinavia to intercept the robins on their migration south. In early winter, the Frankfurt group waits to hear from their northern colleagues that the robins have departed and are en route.
So someone in Northern Europe gives them a phone call when the birds start to come down, and then they rush out and they put on the trees something called mist nets, which, as the name suggests, is fine nets, which just looks like mist to the birds. So the birds try and land in the trees to, you know, rest their wings, and they get stuck in the nets, which don't hurt them, but prevent them from taking off. And then in the morning, the team comes out and they take them out of the nets and they put them in little, you know, hutches, basically. And then typically those birds basically spend the winter in Frankfurt instead of being allowed to fly on to Africa as their urges want them to. And then when they want to fly back north, they're released. So they basically get forced to have alternative wintering arrangements. Now, the way the experiments work is that they take the bird out of its hutch and they put it in a special enclosure at about dusk, because it's then that the European robin likes to make its decision about which way to fly. And the inside of the enclosure is coated with a material which marks very easily. And then the bird literally scratches in the direction it would like to be able to fly. And they allow it to do that for a while, and then they take it, put it back in its hutch, and they look at this paper to see where the scratch is largely. Is it north, west, which direction did the bird want to fly? And of course, what they can do then is they can alter the effective magnetic field.
By manipulating the magnetic fields that the birds experience, the researchers in Frankfurt have been able to probe how the birds can update their sense of direction. One intriguing finding was that this only seemed to work in the presence of light. One conclusion from this is that the avian compass must be dependent on the eyes. In particular, it may involve an intrinsic quantum property of particles known as spin that is related to magnetism.
The idea is you have two electron spins, and they're both like tiny little magnets interacting with Earth's magnetic field and also interacting with the magnetic field produced by nuclear spins in the environment. So both these electrons, they start off in what we call a singlet state, which means if one of them's up, then the other one's down. And then what happens is, in the compass process, a photon is absorbed that puts the system into an excited state and allows one of the two electrons to move either onto a new molecule or a different site on the same molecule. In any case, they're now spatially separated and they're sort of interacting with different local environments, but both feeling Earth's magnetic field. And that changes the quantum state and lets it evolve to a triplet state where the electron spins are parallel as compared to antiparallel for the singlet state. So depending on sort of how long that takes, this process depends on the orientation of the molecule with the external field, with the geomagnetic field, and also obviously on the nuclear field. So what people think is the next part of the story is, depending on whether you end up in the singlet or the triplet state, you can produce different chemicals. And if you have many of these molecules and they're all aligned on the bird's eye, you'd end up producing different chemical concentrations. And you could imagine some sort of neural receptors picking up these concentrations and basically allowing the bird to work out which way it's looking or how it's oriented with respect to the field.
This explanation of the avian compass is called the radical pair hypothesis. While this idea has been around for a few decades, it has only recently come to light that genuine quantum effects seem to be involved, making the avian compass an exciting example of quantum biology. A group of researchers in Frankfurt discovered that if they applied a weak electromagnetic field that oscillated very quickly, at 1.3 MHz, the avian compass was disrupted and the birds could no longer orient themselves. Surprisingly, Benjamin and Gauger's quantum mechanical calculations have revealed that it would take at least 100 microseconds for the effect of the oscillating field to become large enough to block the bird's quantum compass. Importantly, during this time, the quantumness or coherence of the compass also needs to be preserved. This length of time stunned Gauger and co-workers because it significantly exceeds that of comparable systems in the lab. In fact, physicists have been struggling to build quantum computers exploiting exotic quantum phenomena because these prove extremely fragile and decay very quickly in the presence of unavoidable environmental noise. Yet, somehow, these delicate quantum properties can survive for a relatively long time in the tumultuous environment of a bird's brain.
When we try and build our artificial technologies, the prototypes for it, one of the things that we work very hard to do is to try and make these quantum superposition states last for as long as possible. And it's extremely hard because what they want to do is, that word we use is collapse, which means that the quantum state wants to snap to one or the other and then we've lost it. Given the experimental data, given the radical pair hypothesis and our calculations, it would seem that those quantum states must survive for a surprisingly long time.
What was curious was that when Benjamin tried deliberately to destroy the quantum state earlier on in the process of detecting the Earth's magnetic field in his computational models of navigation, the compass sense was not at all affected. These results lead to an even bigger mystery. Why would the bird maintain this long quantum state if it is not actually helpful for navigation? Together with physicist Marshall Stoneham, who has since passed away, Benjamin and Gauger came up with an explanation that leaves the radical pair hypothesis largely in place. But instead of the long quantum state creating chemicals that guide the compass, it leaves a direct trace on the bird's retina.
When the two electrons are pulled apart, or when one of them has been kicked to the other end of the molecule, they form what's called an electric dipole, which is just really to say that you now have moved some electric charge from where it's supposed to be to a distance away. So you have a little effective positive charge, which is where it used to be, the missing charge, as it were, and then there's a negative at the other end where it shouldn't be, it's just moved. And that generates an electric field. Now, if enough of this is happening inside the eye, then you'll get a substantial little electric field just going on there at the back of the eye. It's plausible to suggest that these electric fields directly affect vision. So then what you would have is, if you were the bird and you were looking around at dusk, you would see some kind of interference effect on top of your normal vision. And it does one other thing. It explains why the quantum state would want to last, or why it would be a good thing if it lasted for a long time. because what you're looking at is the longer the radical pair can exist for before it relaxes back, the stronger the electric field will be when there are lots of these guys going on.
It might initially seem surprising to non-specialists that something which is more commonly associated with wildlife documentaries may hold some keys to unlock future advances in quantum technology. Benjamin and Gauger's work exemplifies the potential of quantum biology, where both quantum physicists and biologists can learn from each other. What the former group rely on to create their models in university offices is biological data collected from out in the field. Without this, some of nature's quantum secrets still remain elusive to the human eye.
We've used the data that's available to, you know, actually make, say, as much as we can about the bird's compass, sort of using a proper quantum mechanical treatment. And in order to go further, we need more data first. And now it's time to lean back for a little bit and wait for the next generation of experiments. And as soon as there's more data available, you know, I'd be very keen to pick things up again and see if I can help make sense of them. To me, it's intriguing to see quantum phenomena occurring in natural processes. It's, you know, the very same things which we are trying to harness and to use for the next generation of technologies. And we are struggling to preserve quantum states for sufficiently long time. So if nature's managed to do it before us, we'd certainly like to learn the trick.
Thank you to Simon Benjamin and Eric Gauger, who was speaking with Corinne Pickamer there.
I love that item because I finally understand why you keep calling me a bird brain. I thought it was an insult, but now I realize it's because you think I'm better than a quantum computer.
Yep, that's exactly what I meant. It was a compliment. If, like Brendan, you enjoyed listening to Corinne's item, then the good news is that she will be reporting about more highlights in quantum biology in the next podcast. And if you can't wait till then for more quantum biology, then visit the website www.fqxi.org/community/podcast to hear Luca Turin talking about the quantum mechanics of smell. Okay, so earlier in the podcast, Sean Carroll stated that the underlying physics of all of our everyday experiences can be explained by one equation. That's a very bold claim. What if we've just been fooled into thinking that the fundamental laws of physics are the way they are?
That seems unlikely. Could we really have got them all completely wrong?
Well, no, perhaps not wrong. But while trying to understand a bit more about quantum mechanics in the early universe, cosmologist and FQXI member Andreas Albrecht at the University of California at Davis came up with a very surprising finding, that the fundamental laws of physics we observe may not be unique. Instead, the version of reality that we perceive depends very heavily on the way that we measure time in the early universe, basically on what we choose to use as a clock. His work on this clock ambiguity actually calls into question whether we will ever be able to come up with a single universal set of fundamental laws at all, or any kind of unique theory of everything. Earlier, I spoke with Albrecht about his work. He began by explaining how cosmologists mark time in the early universe compared with how we choose to measure time, usually.
Well, we are all actually pretty good at measuring time. We all need to be places at certain times. We're not always good at getting there on time, but we at least know how we're doing and know if we're running late. And we use a very simple scheme to do that. We have objects in our lives we call clocks, and they're just part of the physical world. They're made out of atoms and particles, just like everything else around us. And we take a look at them, we check what state they're in, and that tells us the time.
But what about, you know, in the very early universe, people talk about, you know, time stretching back to the Big Bang, but at that time, you know, how do we get a handle on how much time has passed?
Well, there certainly weren't any wristwatches in the very early universe. But, well, one thing we know is that there's lots of good clocks all around. It turns out that the physical laws that govern everything we see around us are very regular in time. So it's actually very easy. You have a clock, I have a clock. It's very easy to arrange things so they're pretty much showing the same time, keeping track of the same thing that we call time. And so there's physical processes we follow as we extrapolate back to the beginning of the universe that are really those same reliable processes or relatives of them that we use to make good clocks today in the basic studies of the universe, the galaxies around us. As we extrapolate back, we have a good sense of time, whether it's the oscillations of atoms or the propagation of light. Time means something pretty concrete.
So you've been doing some research of your own that really looks into the question of what a clock is and how that relates to the universe and physical laws. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
As we go beyond the universe that we observe right around us and try to develop an understanding of how it fits into a bigger picture, how it fits into a picture of quantum gravity, of quantum cosmology, we run into an interesting dilemma, because this very concrete notion of clocks and time that I just described actually comes undone at the largest level. And so it turns out at the large level, you're looking at a big picture of the cosmos, and you have to find those individual ingredients that you call your clocks that count the passage of time in your theory. And it turns out there's many choices you can make. And actually, the deep insights from Einstein's theory of gravity tell us it's very important to be able to make all kinds of different choices to preserve the symmetries of the theory. So you actually have a lot of freedom to choose different clocks. And that leads to some very interesting ambiguities, some very profound ambiguities in how we understand the laws of physics.
So let me ask you, when you say that you can make different choices of clocks, what sort of things do you have in mind? What choices do you have?
Well, in terms of choices of clock, what we study when we study the universe around us, we look at, for example, a good choice of clock is sort of the size of the universe. The universe is expanding. As it expands, the temperature goes continuously downward. That's a good clock, just the temperature. Or the density of matter. As the density goes down, the time passes forward, and so we can use that as a measure of time. But we could also say, well, any combination of physical things could be a good clock. And it turns out what I've shown in my calculations is that there are other combinations, other kind of reassembling of these microscopic ingredients of the universe that could describe totally different clocks, describing evolution of a totally different universe. And it's all in there. It's all in there in the same theory. So it's just sort of a rearrangement of the physical ingredients into a new combination that tells you the story of a different universe evolving according to a different clock.
So you're sort of talking there about different universes. So when you set out, were you expecting that depending on your choice of clock and your choice of the measure of time, you would see a different universe, different physical laws? What did you expect to find?
I was expecting something very different, actually. When I set out to study this, I was really just exploring, following through on the implications of this business of needing to select the clock from the physical pieces that you had available. This is something we call internal time. We say internal time is when you find your clock within the system that you're studying. That's such a solid practical notion. It's exactly what we do every day when we check our watches and look at a clock on the wall and so on. So I expected something pretty mundane and practical to come out of that investigation. I was just trying to kind of dot the I's and cross the T's on something that seemed very logical and straightforward to me. So I was absolutely stunned when I discovered that this process of being completely open about how you identify the clock led to absolutely profound ambiguity in how we see the physics in our universe.
So can you explain a bit more what you mean by this profound ambiguity?
So we have the clocks, and they all agree with each other to a good approximation. They describe one set of physical laws. We have strong evidence that the same physical laws govern here, in the next galaxy, and across the universe. So there's this great unity of the system. All the laws actually hang together and cooperate to describe one consistent picture. What I found, though, was that suppose you out of the pure imagination come up with a totally different set of possible physical laws, and then someone else, we go next door and get another story, just fantasies about physical laws and stories about the universe. Any one of those fantasies can be realized within the same physical structure. So if I construct a theory that's just meant to describe the concrete physics I see around me, and then I construct the complete theory, when I'm done, I have within that same theory an equally good description of anybody's fantasy of an alternative universe with alternative laws.
So is that something we should be worried about? Does this sort of call into question our understanding of the physical laws of our universe, or is it a good thing?
When I first encountered this puzzle, I felt really disturbed and uncomfortable about it. I felt it was actually, it was undermining our ability to really believe strong, concrete facts about the universe. It all seemed to be very ambiguous and open. It was, seemed very random to me. But then I thought about it and I realized if this is really the right picture, there's a really cool opportunity, which is maybe among all this randomness and among all this sort of democracy among different types of physical laws, there's a natural selection process that will tell us that actually there's a prediction that certain types of laws will appear more prominently than others when you look at the ensemble. And there may actually be a kind of selection and even prediction of what the typical laws of physics would be like. And if that is actually how it works out, and we really do make some sharp predictions, to me that's a much more satisfying source of insight into the nature of physical laws than we would get just by writing down some theory off the top of our head and then discovering that it was verified by experiment. I think developing an understanding of what physical laws ought to be like by considering a whole ensemble of all possibilities and discovering that some are better represented than others, that seems much deeper. So I'm actually very excited in a positive way about this line of research.
And so does it look like the description that we have of the universe is the best description? It is the one which is the strongest sort of representation?
It's early to tell in detail, but I'm stunned at how the first little baby steps I've taken in this direction have actually turned out really well. So we've worked out that indeed the fundamental tool we use to describe physics called local field theory, that's absolutely verified as any one of these random universes would strongly preferentially have a local field theory description. And the other thing we've checked is that, so Einstein's special relativity is the technical name for the physics behind it is Lorentz symmetry. So Lorentz symmetry is seen everywhere we look. And what we've shown is that in this process of analyzing the full random ensemble of physics, that there's a very, very, very strong preference for Lorentz symmetry among the theories in the ensemble. So it's a very exciting result, because once you have Lorentz symmetry, a lot of the features we see in our universe follow very naturally.
So just to sort of clarify, the idea is that you could choose a different type of clock when you're thinking about how to describe the universe, and that at first sight appears to lead you in different directions in terms of the physical laws that would describe the universe. But when you analyze it more carefully, there seems to be some preference for one set of these physical laws that seems to match the description we have.
That's right. That's exactly what I'm seeing. And there's a lot more to be checked and a lot more to discover. And it's actually very exciting because we should be able to learn more. We should be able to take the line of reasoning I'm using and push it even further. But so far, it's had really great results.
So one thing that we've been talking about is whether time is really fundamental. Given the sort of work that you've been doing, does that lead you to form an opinion on that?
Yes, it does. So from the point of view of this research, I would say time, what time is a fundamental need. So we need time to interpret the universe. And in the most fundamental level, the description of the universe does not necessarily have time in it. But as we seek out a clock to meet this need, so we are beings that interpret the universe via reference to a clock. And so as you go about selecting a clock to use as your reference in your experience of the universe, through meeting that need, you pin down certain properties of the physical laws. So it's not a fundamental thing, but because it's fundamental to us, it guides us in interpreting the basic features of the universe.
Oh, this is a bit of a strange question, but you've sort of been talking about how much we need time in order to interpret physical laws. If we were alien beings or some other type of consciousness that maybe chose a different clock or had a different sense of time, would we come out or interpret the universe in a different way with different physical laws that were just as valid for us based on the type of entity we were?
I think we would. I think that's the basic insight of the set of ideas. But what I've learned so far is that as we scan the range of possibilities of different alien beings, different life forms, interpreting potentially different laws, there seems to be some unity of results where there's at least certain features of the universe that we know and appreciate well seem to repeat themselves across this broad spectrum of possibilities.
That was Andreas Albrecht talking to Zia. You can read more about his work in an article and video on the website www.fqxi.org/community/podcast. Looking at my clock, I can see that we've run out of time, and according to the laws of physics that I perceive, that means it's time to say goodbye.
Thank you again to Sean Carroll, Simon Benjamin, Eric Gauger, and Corinne Pickermer. He's been Brendan Foster.
And she's been Zia Morali.